The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Redeemed, rehabilitated, and real entertaining. This is the Carl Jackson Podcast.
All right, welcome to today's edition of the Carl Jackson Show Podcast. This is your daily dose of objective truth in a world of confusion and lies. Guys, I decided that I wanted to do something different, and I have a couple of gentlemen that are going to be joining me to break down the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. We're going to do a series on the Bill of Rights, Amendment 1 through 10, but we're going to also talk about what led to the Bill of Rights and the importance of that. And so you're going to want to stay tuned for not only to today's show, and you're not only going to want to share today's show, but you're going to have shows to look forward to that you can reference in the future going forward. That's what I wanted to do. I want to kind of rediscover the Bill of Rights. I think so many, we get caught up in these battles, Republican, Democrat, red versus blue, libertarian, this person, that person, and we forget the substance. We forget the Bill of Rights. We forget what makes America and what has made America so unique and what has made America the greatest country that God has ever given man. Despite our flaws, despite our history, when we go into these Bill of Rights, when we dive into the founding principles, I think you're going to be able to, I think you're going to grow a new love for our country, a new love, if you will, for our founders. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. So these gentlemen are going to help me do that. And I'll introduce them in just a sec. I have Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson joining me today from the National Center for Constitutional Constitutional Studies. They've written the book behind the Bill of Rights. If you can see that on the camera, behind the Bill of Rights. This is the same organization that wrote the book, The 5,000 Year Leap, which is another book you guys should have on your shelves as a reference. So make sure you get these books, you share these books, and make sure you share this podcast. Now, before we go any deeper, I just want to say that this show is brought to you in part by MyPillow.com, Mike Lindell at MyPillow, the patriot that he is. Guys, he's providing American jobs and American manufacturing and great products. So his latest product is the new MyPillow 2.0. It comes with the same patented adjustable feel as the original MyPillow, but he has this new temperature regulating thread that makes it softer, smoother, and cooler, so you get an even better night's rest. And on top of that, there's a buy one, get one free offer exclusive to my listeners. All you have to do is go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square at the top of the page, enter my name, Carl, C-A-R-L. Or if you prefer, give them a call at 800-858-0263. Again, mention my name, Carl, to get your buy one, get one free offer of the new MyPillow 2.0. All of the products come with a 10-year warranty, a 60-day money-back 60-day money-back guarantee. I couldn't get that out. So you cannot beat that with a bat. MyPillow.com. We'll take a quick break for some program messaging, and we'll be right back with our guest. Okay, welcome back to the show, guys. And now I want to introduce my guests again. We're speaking with both Jeremy Nelson and Bill Norton. They are from the National Center for Constitutional Studies. Guys, welcome to the Carl Jackson Show podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having us.
You so much, Carl.
All right, absolutely. Okay, this is so weird because you freaked me out for a second here, Jeremy. We were discussing technical difficulties before we came on, and when I looked at my screen, you were on a different side, and so I didn't see you, and I was like, oh my God, we're already starting. But you're loud and clear, and so that works perfectly. That works perfect. All right, guys, I want to dive in, obviously, to the Bill of Rights. This is going to be a series that people are going to be able to come back to and reference. But let me start with you guys on a personal level. We'll start with you, Bill. Where did you, I mean, what's your background? Why did you see this need or have this desire to write about our founders, to write about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights? Where did this come from?
So about 30 years ago, I had a desire to start learning a little bit more about the Constitution. And so I started diving in. And right about that time, I had a friend introduce me to a book called The Making of America, which is a textbook produced by the National Center for Constitutional Studies. And so I just started diving into that book. My background is I'm a high school dropout construction guy. My brother and I own a custom concrete company in the Phoenix area. And so when I'd be out on the job site during lunch break, I'd pull that textbook out and find a shady spot start reading through that. And so over the years, I just began learning more and more about the Constitution and the founders. And I realized if I really wanted to know and understand the founders, I needed to read what they read. So I started studying, you know, John Locke, Montesquieu, and others, and really trying to put myself in the same frame of mind that the founders were. And then eventually, people just started asking me to teach them, and so getting involved at the National Center for Constitutional Studies, eventually started teaching seminars for them around the country. And I always wanted to tackle the Bill of Rights from a perspective of principles, not just on the surface level. Here's, you know, how the courts have interpreted them and so on and so forth. But what are the fundamental underlying principles that exist in the Bill of Rights? And so when the opportunity came for Jeremy and I to tackle that and to write this for the National Center for Constitutional Studies, it was really an exciting prospect to be able to dive into that, because that's really been my fundamental interest in the Constitution, is the underlying principles. I love natural law principles. I love how simple they are. I love to discover them. I love how much of a guidance they are for our lives, not just politically, but in every aspect of our life. And so it was just really exciting to dive into the Bill of Rights on a principled level.
All right, I like that. Okay, so now what about you, Jeremy? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
So it's been an interesting journey, actually. I became introduced to these materials very early in my life. My dad became involved in the National Center for Constitutional Studies back in the mid to late 80s. And so I kind of grew up with these things. I met Cleon Skousen when I was a late teenager, and just began developing a love for my country and the basic principles that we're founded on. And so I've grown up with these things. I grew up on a wheat farm in southern Idaho, and so that's kind of my background. As I got older, I became very much involved. In fact, in the year 2000, I became intimately involved with the National Center for Constitutional Studies in working with, you know, helping with their IT and different things in that respect. And just kind of evolved over the years in directing more of what happened with the National Center for Constitutional Studies. And then, I don't know, shortly after that, I was introduced to Bill, and we started working together on different projects here and there. He would help out with graphic design and so forth, and we just had him come and help in different respects throughout the years. So that's been really fun. We've developed quite a relationship over the course of about 20 years, I think, hasn't it been, Bill? It's been a while, and it's been a good journey. So that's kind of my background. We when we when we started thinking about different ways that we could, you know, produce new materials, we were just getting a lot of interest on our website directly focused on the Bill of Rights. We had the amendments, or we had the Constitution on our website, and then also the Bill of Rights, and then the other amendments, and the traffic to the specifically to the Bill of Rights page was huge. I mean, it was a massive amount of traffic just continually, and so we thought, well, there seems to be an interest there, and let's explore that. And so we started a little bit with just maybe making a pamphlet, and from that idea, it turned into a whole book. And so it was quite a journey as we as we started to develop our ideas and flush them out more. It just began. It just got bigger and bigger until we ended up with this final product behind the Bill of Rights.
Okay, let me do this, and you guys feel free to tag team these questions, or you know, if you prefer one answer the question over the other, go ahead and do that. You know, that's absolutely fine. If you feel like there's something that I should be adding to the conversation, feel free to add on to that. We're here to learn from you today. We're here to learn more about our Constitution, our founders, the importance of the Bill of Rights. Let me start with this. This is related but unrelated. I read a headline the other day, and then I see it's popping up everywhere. But originally from Breitbart, that Generation Z, approximately 30% of Generation Z that was polled, said they would be willing to have government surveillance cameras inside of their homes. And I sat there. The first thing I thought when I saw that headline, and I read a little bit of the article, and I sat there and thought, these young people don't get it. These people, if they're left in charge, they would totally lose this country. And I feel like we're losing this country. And that's a reason why part of the reason why I'm like, man, we really need to understand why America is so great and so important. But that headline, I gotta admit, it scared the bejeebers out of me. Let me get a quick response from one or both of you. Have you seen that headline or seen that story, and your take on it quickly before we move on?
Yeah, I saw the headline a couple of days ago on that. And what's interesting about it is the polling data overall for all the age groups wasn't that horrible, but when they dive down into that younger Gen Z, it was pretty appalling how many people were willing to let government have cameras in their home. There's a couple of things. First of all, on the positive side, quite often when those younger generations are interviewed or polled, there's a degree of idealism that comes with youth, quite often those views do change over the course of 5 and 10 years as those generations are getting older. So that's a little bit positive, knowing that those views will probably change once they feel a little bit more of the heavy hand of government, once they start paying taxes, and once they start feeling a little bit of that oppression, they're probably going to have different opinions. However, it does mean that they're coming into adulthood without an understanding of human nature and without an understanding of the historical examples that we have when it relates to tyranny and oppression versus freedom and liberty. And so that's really the biggest thing that I see with that. Isn't necessarily their opinion, but it's their lack of knowledge of history and how government interacts with their citizens throughout history. And that's exactly why the Bill of Rights came to be. And what's interesting about the Bill of Rights is that much of the Bill of Rights wasn't brand new. Even a lot of the language was, some of it's even hundreds of years old. It goes back to parts of the Magna Carta, which is, you know, in the 1200s. And then you have parts of the English Bill of Rights, which is like 1600s. And so this goes way back with just a lot of historical references that youth today just don't have because we're not teaching them history nearly as much as we should.
Yeah, and I think part of my concern is that the youth are so part of my concern is that they're growing used to a surveillance state. They're on their phones all the time. They're on social media all the time. It's become part of their lived experience, if you will. And I also fear that some of the issues that the left is bringing up, I think a lot of kids are being brainwashed in our schools today. I almost feel like to be anti-American and to be anti-founders and to be anti-Bill of Rights is kind of become a secular cult type movement where it's become a new morality, amongst some of the younger people in the nation. So even though we, you know, it's like you would hope they would be smacked upside of the head with the reality of taxes and so on, et cetera, as they get older, I'm like, I'm not so sure anymore, simply because I believe the left has found this new morality that is they're indoctrinating our younger kids into communism, socialism, so on. And I'm just like, man, this could get really bad really fast. But still, the answer lies in, I believe, rediscovering the Bill of Rights and what you guys have written about. And that's why I think this book is so important. You know, there's something and I may go back and forth. So if you guys feel the need to go back or forward or whatever, feel free to do just that. But there's a simple concept I can't even that you guys mentioned in the book, and I want to make sure that I get this I get this right, and then I want to go to the preamble to the Bill of Rights. But I started thinking about the issue of slavery, and I started diving into the First Amendment, the freedom of religious expression, and you guys, and now I can't find it, but I'll essentially paraphrase or at least parathought, if you will. I thought about when based upon your writing, I'm like, oh my God, I never sat and just took the time to think that a lot of people, when it comes to like the issue of slavery, specifically, people were not free necessarily to have their own thoughts. I mean, it's such a simple concept, but it's amazing to me when you think about the First Amendment and the freedom of religion. What our founders did was basically freed Americans up to just have their own thoughts. And early Americans, this is what it was. Early Americans struggled with the idea of the freedom of thought. And you know what? I never even thought about that. And I started thinking, wow, you know, slavery was universal. It wasn't just something unique to the United States, obviously. But if man, men and women, but if man in any, you know, any time and place in history, if they were ruled over, then they were going to follow the dictates of their ruler. That was just the way that they lived. So to all of a sudden have this, oh, wait a minute, we can be free. You can start thinking about the sin nature, things that are wrong. I'm talking a little too much here, but I want to get you guys to respond to that. It was just a sentence I was reading over, and it just hit me. I was like, oh my God, you're right. The first, you know, the Americans, they struggled to understand what freedom meant.
Yeah, and Carl, just to preface your comments and your interest in that topic in the book, this was kind of interesting how it evolved in the book, because we didn't have any intent in writing, putting anything in the book about slavery, because there's nothing in the Bill of Rights about slavery. And so... As we had an editor from New York that was editing the book and kind of going through and giving perspective and whatnot. And early on, one of the comments he made is that, hey, you don't have anything in here about slavery. And we're like, well, yeah, I mean, the Bill of Rights doesn't talk about slavery. But he said, you know, you're talking about all these natural rights and about all men are created equal and all this stuff. And so it seems like a really, really big oversight to not even bring up that topic. And so at that point, we started discussing it, Bill and I, and just talking about it. And like, is there anything to that? Do we need to put something about slavery in there? And the more we talked about it, the more we realized that we really did. And so that perspective from somebody who's, he's definitely more liberal. But that was really a good insight for us to understand and then incorporate that section into the book. So Bill can speak more to directly to the content of the of slavery that we put in the book.
Bill, why don't you expound on that for us?
So the slavery one, we could spend a lot of time on it, and we should, because there's some really important concepts there. But to jump into really what your comments are about struggling with freedom, absolutely. And the freedom of religion portion of the First Amendment is a great illustration of that struggle, because the founders started out with this idea of what they called religious tolerance. And they thought that, hey, this is great. We're being so tolerant. And it didn't take them many years before they realized that the position of tolerance is kind of an arrogant position, because it indicates that your belief is correct and you're just being tolerant of the incorrect belief. You know, we're letting the incorrect belief be free to exist. But that's pretty arrogant, because that's saying that your beliefs are correct and the others are not, but you're going to go ahead and let them exist anyway. And so the founders pretty quickly stopped using that term tolerance and really tried to change their way of thinking, that you needed to be just as open to the ideas of others as you want your own ideas to exist. And so they started getting into the freedom of conscience. So originally you had governments that would dictate what religions existed and what religions couldn't exist. And then you got into this tolerance idea, and then they realized, well, that can be just as oppressive. And so they got into the freedom of conscience, where it doesn't really matter what you believe religiously or whatever. It goes right down to the fundamental principle of your right to just to think. You wake up in the morning and you can start thinking whatever you want to think, and it would be the worst of oppressions for anybody else to wake you up in the morning and tell you what you must think today. And that's one of the dangers that we have today. Again, going back to the youth and this idea of cameras in the homes and all that kind of stuff, is that we are, we're in a position now where we're trying to force each other to think the way that we want people to think. We have the cancel culture that is doing exactly that. It's punishing people for the way they think. Right. And we have this huge conflict, and it's not just on the left or the right. It's both sides are really butting heads right now because of the way that we think. And that's a really dangerous position that we find in our society. And so that First Amendment, the religion portion, isn't really about religion. It's again, the fundamental underlying natural law principle is this idea that we have the freedom to think. And once we have the freedom to think, I love the way that the First Amendment is written. We think that it's this loose connection of these concepts. Right. Most people think that the Bill of Rights is basically the First Amendment, because the First Amendment has, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. And so, but it's all very methodical. You have freedom of conscience, we can think. Right. And then we have the freedom of speech. So now we can speak what we think. And then we have freedom of the press, which we can now take what we're thinking and speaking and put it in printed form. And so it's actually all those things are very connected, and it's very methodical. I love how methodical the founders were in the way that they wrote this stuff. James Madison, primarily. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question there about this struggle for freedom that, or this idea of freedom that the founders, you know, they had just as much struggle sometimes as we do. It wasn't just this immediate thing that they just knew exactly how free we should be and how to implement those freedoms. And it was definitely a struggle for them as well.
Yeah, it was a fascinating read. I mean, honestly, just reading on the First Amendment, you made the points that I was actually going to get to on the First Amendment, but I still want to go back to slavery a little bit here. But you made the points on the First Amendment and again, how it wasn't just the founders like, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? Let's add this. Like, no, it was very strategic. It was very methodical. And I love that. It was so simple. It was just illuminating to me. I'm like, oh yeah, duh. Like I had, you know, I memorized the First Amendment because I'll spout it off when I'm on radio or whatever. I want to make sure I know what the heck I'm talking about, develop acronyms so I would never forget it and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, just how methodical it is. It makes total sense. And I think the reason why I want to go back to slavery, and I want you to touch on this as well, Bill, is for this reason. In order for men to be free, including slaves, the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the right to thought, the right to the freedom of conscience was absolutely necessary. Like, people don't understand that we were literally, I mean, I know there was the Magna Carta and I get all that, but most of the world was stuck in, I mean, just slavery was universal. I really believe that this Bill of Rights, this First Amendment in particular, was freeing, not just in the sense of let me try to word this better. It freed man's conscience, and as a result of freeing man's conscience, instead of thinking, okay, just thinking the way the government or your rulers wanted you to think, it was all of a sudden, let me think for myself and for the betterment of all men. If you could kind of connect that point to slavery, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
It totally makes sense. And this is a great example why we have a couple of major sections in the book. The first section is just a brief history, and then we have a section called General Principles, because we realize that there's a lot of fundamental principles that are not necessarily directly addressed in the Bill of Rights, but you must know in order to understand the foundation upon which the Bill of Rights rests. And slavery is one of those things. And so that's where we ended up putting slavery, is in the general principles section, because as the editor, as Jeremy mentioned, the editor's like, hey, this is kind of glaring that you guys don't talk about this. And we realized, well, we really could put it in this general principles area and talk about it on a natural law level, because it does tie to First Amendment, Second Amendment, so on and so forth. And so the slavery issue is extremely important. And we'd really discovered a lot about it. But I think the angle that you're coming at with it is that with the slaves, they were forced to think the way that their masters wanted them to think, even more so than just the general public had government breathing down their necks.
Sure.
And it completely controlled exactly who they were, how they acted, and it was a form of oppression. So that's why many people wouldn't educate their slaves, because they didn't want them to think for themselves. Because thinking, if you want to keep somebody oppressed, thinking is dangerous. And now some of the founders, who struggled with slavery, who were slave owners, but struggled with the institution, they did their best to educate their slaves and to try to, make it so they were able to be free thinking. Like Thomas Jefferson felt it his obligation to make sure that all of his slaves were well educated. And we know a lot about Jefferson and his plantation because so many of his slaves knew how to read and write, and so a lot of them wrote journals and stuff. So we have
that is such a great point.
Yeah. They just wrote a lot. And George Washington had a lot of slaves that also knew how to read and write. But this idea of oppression by forcing somebody to think the way that you want them to think directly ties into slavery and why we have the First Amendment today, so that we are not all oppressed in any degree, whether it's all the way to slavery or even just the slightest degree of oppression by controlling our thoughts. So the slavery issue, what we discovered there is a couple of very important things. Again, we're always looking for the underlying principle. And so what we really learned, and this is what one of the things that we present in the book, is that slavery is not about race. It certainly became about race, certainly, especially toward the end. It was horrible, some of the things that were said about race relations and all that. But really, the idea of slavery, and this is why it's important to understand the underlying principles, because we can all fall into the trap of slavery as either the slave or as the oppressor, if we are not aware of the state of mind that it takes to get into slavery, and that is superiority. Whenever you get into a situation in which you think you are superior over another group of people, whether that be by race or by socioeconomics or by gender or by any of those things, if you believe that you are superior, then you are going to use society and eventually you'll use government to oppress the views of those that you view are inferior, which totally ties to what you were talking about earlier about this new morality, this all this virtue signaling when it comes to so many different subjects today. Whenever we have this virtue signaling, let's go back to even COVID, for example. It was amazing the amount of virtue signaling that was happening among people who really didn't fear the virus. And that's evident today because those are all the people that are no longer wearing masks and stuff. They never really feared it. Because if they did fear it, they'd still be wearing masks because the virus still exists. And so you get into this mindset where you're virtue signaling, and then you want to silence those who have so-called misinformation.
Right.
But it's all this superiority complex where you think that your thoughts, your ideas are superior over another. And if you do that, if you get in that frame of mind, then you are risking becoming an oppressor. And if you get into the state of mind where you're allowing others to convince you that you're inferior, which I think is a lot of what's happening with race relations today, is we're telling whole groups of minorities that you're inferior. Everybody hates you. You cannot get a leg up in society. There's no way that you're going to be able to succeed because everything's stacked against you because you're hated because of your skin color, because of your gender, or for whatever reason. And so those folks are learning from a very young age that they are inferior. And when they get into that mindset, they risk being oppressed. And so it's very important that we desire freedom and liberty for everybody as much as we desire it for ourselves, and recognize that they are just as capable as humans as we are in handling that freedom and liberty.
It's a good point. And let me tack on and get your response to this, Jeremy. A lot of those people that Bill were mentioning that either feel like they're superior or perhaps feel like they're oppressed. Many people feel like they're oppressed because of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and this so-called systemic racism. And it is the complete opposite. Nothing could be further from the truth that America is systemically racist because of our founders and because of our founding principles. Your take, Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. The Constitution is completely gender and race neutral. It talks about a person the only thing that the Constitution mentions with regards to slavery is just how the vote is going to be cast for slaves, so that it's fair to the different states in proportion to their representation. And so there was some debates about how slaves should be accounted for, and it actually was when you get right down to it, it actually was in favor of the northern states versus the southern states, and
we're speaking of the three-fifths vote. I'm sorry to
interrupt. Yeah.
To clarify.
Yeah, that's right. The three-fifths vote, and so it actually favored the northern states versus the southern states. But I don't think most people understand that. They just see that right in the Constitution and see, well, that's a blight in the Constitution. It's inherently racist, and it that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, that's a very, I'm so glad you went to that and made that point, because a lot of people today, particularly people on the left, will use that. Well, this three-fifths vote, I mean, Al Gore used it. And honestly, I think Al Gore was lying. I know he knows better. But the three-fifths vote, you know, they want to keep you guys in chains. They want to do all this. When it was the total opposite, it was to spread freedom. But it's amazing what people will get away with when they don't know the Constitution. Let's do this. I want to get you guys to talk about, this is a simple but difficult principle sometimes to understand and grasp. You guys talk about natural law. Will you explain to the audience what natural law is? And then you wrote about the difference between primitive natural law and sophisticated natural law. So talk to us about what natural law is first and foremost, and then the difference between primitive natural law and sophisticated natural law.
So
there's a,
either one, Jeremy. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, Jeremy, and then I'll tackle it after you. This is a great question, and it'll probably take the opinion of both of us to throw it out there. So go ahead.
Yeah, and I can just briefly overview it, and then Bill, yeah, you can take it from there. But but basically, natural law is just as Cicero said, it's right reason with the laws of nature, and Thomas Jefferson explained that he went a little bit further and said it's the laws of nature and of nature's God, and so these law they really worked on logic. What was logical to them, what they can observe and what they could see. One of the misnomers today is that natural law has to do with a religious code, and there is that thought out there, but that's not what we're talking about. The founders, when they talked about natural law, they were talking about what they could observe through reason, through intellect, through you know, just observation. This is how it works, and so that was it's the idea that, you know, what goes up must come down. You can see that there are things that are this is the way human nature works. This is how we interact in society. So that's just a kind of a brief introduction to natural law. Probably before we get into sophisticated versus primitive natural law. Bill, you want to take a minute?
Yeah. So Jeremy touched on this modern definition. There's a modern definition that some people use to actually, in my opinion, they're using it to debunk this idea of natural law, and that is that it's tied to a moral code or religious code. And this kind of goes back a little bit to like William Blackstone, where William Blackstone divided natural law out into scientific law and then what he called revealed law, things that are hard for us to discover. So God revealed it to us primarily in the Bible. And so Blackstone kind of does bring some religion stuff into it a little bit. But the founders, it's not about religious code for them. It literally is about logic and reason. What can we measure? What can we observe? And if we can observe and measure something, then we can discover the natural law principle behind that thing. And so so we want to, first of all, just get rid of this modern definition that ties it to religious moral code and just stay purely with logic and reason.
Okay.
Because that's where the founders were with it. And so when we look at natural law, it's things that are observable and measurable. And there's a lot of things for government that we can see that, if government does something, then, for example, back to the First Amendment with the freedom of religion, the founders said that when you mix church and state, you end up corrupting both. It's just a natural law principle. It just happens. You can observe it and you can measure it. And so let's not mix church and state. And then hopefully we won't end up with the corruption of both. And it's been true to a large degree. So natural law is very important there. So basically it's simple. It's not that confusing. It's just the way things are and the way that, and we can discover them. So I was sitting there and I was explaining, had some family and stuff around and was explaining some natural law principles to one member of the family. And another member of the family all of a sudden kind of jumped up. He wanted to interject in the conversation, but I'm not sure that he knew exactly how. And so he just simply said, "Well, I'm stronger than you. I can beat you up and take your food. That's natural law." And then he walked off from there. And the point he was trying to make was that all this stuff about we have freedom and rights and all those things, how are those natural law if nature made me stronger than you and I can just take your stuff? And so right. That must be a natural law principle as well. So forever I used to just kind of ignore that and just say, well, that's just – it's not the natural law we're talking about. And I realized – and as Jeremy and I were discussing this, we thought, you know what? We really do need to address this because it is true. Survival of the fittest is a natural law principle. If somebody is bigger and stronger, then they absolutely can take your stuff, which is one reason why we offset that with the right to bear arms, right? That kind of is the great equalizer. But nonetheless, we had to address this and we realized if humans want to live that way, where the strongest person can take the weaker people's stuff, then we can. In fact, humans have lived that way more often than not in history. But right. That's a primitive natural law. Mm-hmm. That's if we don't want to elevate society. That's if we just want hand-to-mouth survival of the fittest. And so we realize if we want to elevate into a higher level of society, then we have to have reach out to a more sophisticated natural law. So if you want relationships to be long lasting, you can't just beat somebody up and take their stuff because that relationship is going to deteriorate very quickly. And so if we want to live in a society where we can all grow and advance, regardless of our physical strength or even our mental strength, that we can all progress without being oppressed, we have to get to a more sophisticated level of natural law. So while nature says that we can beat somebody up, the natural law principles of relationships say you shouldn't beat up your neighbor if you want to have a good relationship with that neighbor. So that's why we started distinguishing in the book. And we kind of coined those phrases because nobody, to our knowledge, has really separated it that clearly. And so yeah. We thought, well, we're going to separate it, and so we coined the phrases of primitive and versus sophisticated, simply because we wanted to illustrate the point that primitive natural law, you're going to take us back a few thousand years if you want to live by those principles. Sure. And again, we're starting to live by those principles today. This yep. whole cancel culture is a primitive natural law. It's like my mob is stronger than your mob. Yeah. And so we're going to win purely because we're the ones that are tearing down monuments, and we're the ones that are rioting, and we're the ones that are doing all this. And that's just really primitive natural law, and it's not good for society.
You can observe those things, and so this is really where it you begin to understand what natural law is and how it's applied. Because you can observe what communism does. You can see those countries. You can see how the people live. In the United States, you can see that there's or at least there has been differences in how people live. How much wealth they can collect. Whatever. Their standard of living is higher than in many other countries because of the principles of sophisticated natural law that are being applied versus primitive natural law. And so there again, it's just, you can observe it. It's observable and measurable.
That's good. Honestly, I'm glad that you guys made that distinction. And part of the reason why is this, because when you talk about logic and reason, the both of you, I love the fact that the difference between primitive and sophisticated, simply because I think it's easy to conflate what you essentially branded sophisticated natural law with a moral code. I've done it myself, frankly, in the past. And so that's why I think it's very important to make this distinction. And I'm glad you guys did. Again, I'm speaking to the authors, Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. They are the authors of Behind the Bill of Rights. You can go out and get this book. I still have more questions for them, but this is a book that you guys should have on your shelves as a reference book. I'm going to be using it as that. And also, I'm going to do more reading. I haven't finished reading this book. I'm far from it, as a matter of fact. It's just been crazy times. But I was reading through it this morning, and I'm like, man, it's so good. It's so clear. It helps you to understand the importance of the Bill of Rights. Guys, I want to talk about the preamble to the Bill of Rights. What page is it on? I was reading that earlier. And I want to read it. I was sitting in for Dennis Prager on his program yesterday, and I told the audience that I was going to be starting a series on my podcast talking about the Bill of Rights with you guys. And a gentleman called in, and he said, "Well, Carl, make sure if you're doing a series on the Bill of Rights that you talk about the preamble to the Bill of Rights." And I'm thinking the preamble to the Constitution. He's like, "No, the preamble to the Bill of Rights." And here you guys have it on page 20. And I'll tell you where he stopped in his concern, but I just want to read it for the sake of the audience because it's very important. But it says here, "The conventions of a number of states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its power, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent," I've never read that word before, I hope I got that right, "ends of its institution." But the part that he really focused on was that the expressed desire by our founders and their desire to prevent the misconstruction or the abuse of its power, meaning the government. And a lot of people forget that the Bill of Rights is actually a list of, forgive me if I'm framing this incorrectly. Yes, prohibitions, things that the government cannot do to you. It's amazing, but you guys take that on if you would.
Yeah, I mean you're absolutely right. The Bill of Rights, I mean, it sounds like it's a listing of our rights, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Of course, it does identify some of our rights, and this was a concern that the founders had, and kind of the debate between the different sides of, you know, we don't need a Bill of Rights. Alexander Hamilton was saying, you know, that could even be dangerous to have a Bill of Rights because people may assume that that's all of their rights. And that was not the intent. The intent was to limit the national government and prevent them from overstepping their bounds, especially in these certain areas. And the other side of the thought is that you know, kind of the Federalist side was, well, we haven't given government, we haven't in the Constitution, we haven't given government enough power to abuse our rights, and some of them, including George Mason, just said, you know, they will, they always do, go beyond, and so you need to have a Bill of Rights, and restrict the power of government.
Yeah. Do you want to add on to that?
Yeah, I wish they would have. I really wish the founders would have put that preamble right in one of the amendments, because technically the preamble is not part of the Constitution because it was not ever ratified as an amendment. But it's so important. In fact, when we get to the Ninth Amendment, we discover how important the Bill of Rights or the preamble is when it's talking about preventing the misconstruction of the Constitution, or the misinterpretation is really what they're saying there. Because the Ninth Amendment, we've been interpreting that incorrectly for years. And when Jeremy and I dove into it, we discovered that there's a lot more, there's a hidden meaning behind the Ninth Amendment, and it has a lot to do with what's stated in the Bill of Rights or in the preamble. So it would have been nice if they would have put that preamble right in one of the amendments, so that we could officially say that is language that's now officially part of the Constitution. Real fast, I wanted to go back onto a point that you made with natural law about how sometimes you conflate principles of natural law with moral codes. And that's not a necessarily a bad thing, even though I kind of mentioned earlier that that's kind of this modern definition. The reason why it's not a bad thing is because there's a lot of moral principles in moral codes that are natural law principles.
Right.
But we need to recognize that sometimes our moral codes may violate natural law. So we might have to adjust our moral codes from time to time once we discover and measure things. But things come match up quite often. Like the easiest one is murder. We don't murder, we don't have it against the law to murder people because it's against the Ten Commandments, because it's against that moral code. We have it against the law because murdering is violating the natural right of another to live. And so when we pass these laws, laws should always be there to prevent the violation of rights, not to promote a moral code. But that doesn't mean...
That's good. Okay.
But it doesn't mean that they don't sometimes become one and the same. Murdering is both natural law and it's part of a good moral code. And so it's just important to recognize, okay, there's times when they do match up, but that doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong because your moral code lines up with natural law. It just means that your moral code is actually good because it's lining up with natural law.
You know what? I'm so glad that you went back to that, because I mean, literally, in order for America is an experiment, right? I mean, we have all of these different ethnic groups and cultures that come together to become one culture, and that's, man, that's a fascinating differentiation there. I like that. We don't want to violate another person's natural law, because we live in a pluralistic society, which is that's good, man. These guys were brilliant, and they were young. I mean, a couple of them weren't, but they were young. It's just fascinating to me how brilliant these guys were and thought it through. And it saddens me that we'll look at the the sin of slavery. Obviously, I believe it's a sin. I'm a Christian. I think it was absolutely wrong and abhorrent, but it was universal. It's what the world knew, and we ended it here. And we ended it here in the United States because of our founding principles. So I just think that that's really cool. You guys kind of touched on what the Bill of Rights are about, essentially, and somewhat how they came to be. The founders that were responsible for the Bill of Rights. Why don't you guys talk to us about them for a second? Jeremy, we'll start with you, and then we'll let you wrap that up there, Bill.
Yeah, so that there were to say that many people didn't have an influence in the amendments into the Bill of Rights would be incorrect, but there were three main people that probably influenced them the most. One of these was George Mason. Now, he probably influenced the Bill of Rights the most of anybody, and it kind of goes back to his Virginia Declaration of Rights that he wrote, and as you trace the different things, including the Declaration of Independence, the different documents. And the different states' declarations of rights or bills of rights, much of the language that George Mason put in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and this was in 1776, actually before the declaration was signed, that a lot of those thoughts can be found traced right through these other documents, including the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and you can even find them in some of the United Nations codes and things today. And so he really nailed it with the Virginia Bill of Rights. And if you haven't read that, it's worth the read just to really understand and see those basic principles. One of the other people that obviously, or two of the other people that influenced the Bill of Rights more from an intellectual standpoint through their writings and different things was Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. James Madison being the one that actually compiled the Bill of Rights. And so when the state started suggesting different amendments that they could put in to the Constitution, which was almost 200, James Madison was taking all of those, kind of organizing them, combining them, and whatever. And then finally got to the point where he presented them back to the states for ratification. But those are the three main: George Mason, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison.
That's fascinating. And it was, let me ask this: was George Mason, was he an abolitionist? Because I know plenty of the founders were, and that never gets spoken of. But I'm not sure if he was or wasn't. But was he?
Yeah, he absolutely was.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, back at that time, an abolitionist was somebody who was trying to change it through policy and trying to kind of evolve into the change. Whereas as it got later, closer to the Civil War, abolitionists were a little bit more aggressive, like John Brown and others. And so it's important that we kind of distinguish what that term meant back with the founders versus kind of what it ended up meaning, 60 or 80 years later.
Sure. That's good.
So my favorite founder is James Madison. And he's considered the father of the Constitution, but also considered the father of the Bill of Rights. So his work that went into the Bill of Rights was awesome. He, of course, did have his mentor and friend, Thomas Jefferson, as Jeremy mentioned, and then his predecessor, also from Virginia, George Mason. Madison, really, he we kind of picture sometimes writing of the Bill of Rights the same as the Constitution was written, where it's just a group of men that got together and they argued and debated and all that in kind of somewhat of an informal setting with the Constitutional Convention. Well, now we're in a formal setting. Now the government has been put in place. Congress exists. The president exists. And so the Bill of Rights is now being debated in Congress. James Madison was serving in the House of Representatives at the time. And so it kind of puts a different picture in our mind where instead of just this meeting on the side like the convention was, now we have this really formal structure with constitutional or with congressional procedure and all that the Bill of Rights had to go through. And so James Madison took a lot of these suggestions from the states. Initially, James Madison was not in support of a Bill of Rights. But the reason why he was tackling it, because he's like, hey, this is something that the states wanted. It's something that that we said that we would put in place if they would ratify it. Wow. And so we have to do it. Wow. And so he was purely doing it because of his commitment to others. But then as he started getting deeper into it and actually started writing them, he realized, yeah, this is pretty important stuff. And so he became a champion of the Bill of Rights and not only doing it just because he had an obligation, like he started out. But he took all those almost 200 suggestions, boiled them down to about 17.
That's insane.
And the way that we count all these is different because they were just sometimes like the First Amendment. Sometimes those were separate amendments, the different ideas in there. Then they combine them. And so it's really, really hard to track the debates. Because they just numbered them differently and they put them in different orders and all that. But nonetheless, he took them, he boiled them down to about 17. Congress passed 12 of them, and then they went out to the states. And the first two did not pass or were not ratified. And so the First Amendment we know today was the Third Amendment. And the Second Amendment that we know today was the Fourth Amendment. And so it gets confusing in history because the founders were actually referring to those amendments by their numbers, but the numbers are incorrect based on the numbering sequence. In fact, they kept it for about a year and a half when they first ratified them. The First Amendment was still the Third Amendment. They kept their ordering of numbers because they were waiting for those other two to be ratified, and they never were. So they finally changed the numbering sequence. But what's interesting is that the original Second Amendment ended up being passed 1992. Is that right, Jeremy? The 27th Amendment. And so that floated around for, well over 150 years and was finally passed. And it's not that the states disagreed with the 27th Amendment. They just didn't think that it rose to the level of a subject that should be put in the Constitution. And it just says the 27th Amendment just says that the existing Congress cannot give themselves a raise. So while everybody agreed to it, they're like, that's too trivial to be in the actual document. But then finally we ended up passing that many years later. So really the Bill of Rights that we have today, James Madison is the mastermind behind most of the language and the approach. And there's a couple things that we, discovered as we were writing the book that we kind of were upset with James Madison. He wasn't clear enough on a couple of things. The Ninth Amendment, again, there's some total hidden meanings in the Ninth Amendment that we discovered that's just fantastic. And his original draft, his original language of the Ninth Amendment was so clear and so good, but he reduced it for, I don't know, for brevity's sake or whatever. I don't know why, but the language becomes ambiguous. And so we're kind of like, Madison, he should have just left it the way that okay, you.
That's going to be a fascinating podcast then, because I can't wait to get to the Ninth Amendment. Just hearing that, honestly, that's fascinating. That's good stuff.
It's a good one. The Ninth Amendment blew us away when we really started diving into it.
Man, that's pretty cool. Okay, guys, let me do this. I want to close out today's podcast, but before I do, we made mention of the First Amendment, but I just want to reiterate for people, because I want to make sure that they understand how methodical the First Amendment was. So I just want to go back through that real quickly. And again, I'm speaking with my guests. They are the authors of Behind the Bill of Rights, Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. This is a book that you need to go out and get. And literally, here's where I am. You can call me a nut jobs, a conspiracy theorist. I just believe the world is going completely cray cray. And I think that you need to have as many written books as possible, because I think the left has gotten extremely crazy and extremely dangerous in the United States of America. And I think it's important for us to have resources that we can go back to, that we don't have to fear that they'll be erased. Call me a conspiracy theorist, call me whatever you want. I don't care. I have old school bookshelves and I think you should too, frankly. So go out and get this book, Behind the Bill of Rights by Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. Guys, before we close out, and you guys feel free to offer your commentary, but I just want to go point by point. I'm going to go sentence by sentence, if you will, in the First Amendment. And actually, when I say sentence by sentence, what I really want to do is go with your breakdown, and you guys made mention of it, but I just want to make sure that we leave the audience with it as I try to reference back to it. All right, but first let's read the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting, you know what, I'm reading this. Let's talk about this for just a second. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. A lot of people misconstrue this as far as, okay, well, that means separation of church and state. Just add some clarity to that. Jeremy and then Bill, please add some clarity to that line before we break down freedom of religious expression, freedom of speech and the press, right to assemble, right to petition. Break down that line for me, if you would, starting with you, Jeremy. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got it now. Sorry. Okay. I had it on mute there for just a second. So, okay. So the intent was absolutely to keep to make sure that we're not having this scenario with King George, being buddy buddy with the Pope or anything like that. I mean, we're separate. And we're not going to establish a state church. It's interesting because at this time, this did not apply to the states. And so the states were, some of them still had state churches, even past when the Bill of Rights was adopted.
Interesting.
So it was completely just, they were just saying, look, we don't want the national government to have anything to do with telling us how we're going to think, how we're going to believe. That's all left up to the states or the people. And eventually the states all bought onto that and put that into their constitutions as well, that, we're not, people are free to believe whatever they want. We're not going to have a state church. And so that was really the intent.
There was still a couple, like Jeremy mentioned, there are still states. The couple of states that still had state-sponsored churches existed all the way into and past Thomas Jefferson's administration, which he was the third president. I mean, this is going many years into the federal government existing. It's so important to understand the concept of federalism, which again, we cover in the general principles. when it comes to this issue, because you're right. It says no, Congress shall make no law, none, not for, not against, not policing the states, not nothing, no law. And what happened was when the 14th Amendment got written, which that's not in the Bill of Rights, so we don't really cover that deeply in the book. But when the 14th Amendment was written and then later reinterpreted, the court said, you know, the federal government is the policing agency over the Bill of Rights, essentially, to force the states to follow the Bill of Rights. Well, the Bill of Rights is in the federal or the national constitution. It was a limitation on those on the national government, not on the states. The states were kind of left to their own. Okay. And so what ended up happening is when the courts came in and said the federal government becomes the entity to enforce this, now the federal government will pass laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting it based on enforcing the Bill of Rights on the states. Hmm. And that's the founders are like, no law. But yet they come in and they do pass laws now and say, well, we're doing this in the name of separation of church and state, enforcing that on the states. And wow. So now we've had a violation, some major violations of the First Amendment. And so it's not only important to understand what the verbiage of these amendments are, but to also understand the document that they're in is for the federal government. We need to understand the concept of federalism. When we're putting this stuff in place, and we have to, whether you're conservative or liberal, you have to be mindful of that. There's a lot of times when even conservatives, there will be an issue before the national government, and we're like, we're all for it. Yes, let's force this on the states.
Yeah,
you know, it's a good principle, it's a good concept, but yeah. We're doing it at the wrong level.
Yeah,
because we're violating federalism. We're violating a natural law principle with federalism when we want the federal government to be the police over certain issues.
And I won't say who, and I won't say the topic, but one of the Republican candidates, frankly, that I would like to see become president, mentioned an idea, and I was like, that is a really good idea. And then I thought, but I don't want the federal government telling me about it. So it can happen on both sides. It's a very, very important point. All right. So let's just real quickly, if we can, I'll go to both of you. I just want the quick breakdown of the First Amendment. We did general principles. And actually, I'll refer back to general principles when we do other podcasts as well on the second, third, all the way up to the 10th Amendment. And man, I'm salivating for Amendment 9 now since you talked about that. We may even have to throw in a bonus of the 14th Amendment because you've referenced that a couple of times. So I'm fascinated about that. But the freedom of religious expression. Basically, our individual rights begin with the ability to think for ourselves, essentially, and believe. So let's get your take. Basically, I said what you guys wrote, but let's get a quick take from the both of you, starting with you, Jeremy.
Yeah, so the idea was that there's that distinction, that separation. So we can believe what we want. Basically the freedom of religion. But that really goes back to the freedom of thought, and can anybody rightfully say that they can control somebody's thoughts? I mean, there's ways that people try to through media and through, you know, brainwashing, through, you know, education in the schools at some points and different things like that. But can you really control what people think? That's kind of a natural right. It's something that we just all inherently have. And so that's really the first thing. And if we have a right to think, then we also have a right to, you know, process those thoughts and start, you know, believing in different things that we feel, are valid based on our observations of the world around us, the things that we see, the things that we hear, we can start forming beliefs. And then if we have that right to believe in those things, which I mean, that is derived from our thoughts, then we have to have the right to speak them. Because to deprive that right would basically make us a slave inside ourselves. We're only able to think. If God gave us the ability to think and to form opinions, then to deny us the right to speak those things would make us a slave. And then since we have the right to speak those things, and really the speech and the press are kind of one and the same in a way, because we can speak them, we can write them, but then we can also get together and we can assemble to discuss our thoughts and our beliefs, and so that's really a natural next step. Is coming together and discussing things that are important to us, and that's how we learn. Is that we get together, we talk about our different thoughts, and we can change our beliefs based on that. So these are just very fundamental, basic concepts. And then if government gets to the point where it gets out of control, we have the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So we have a right to come together as people and to speak the things that we believe as we've gathered together in a community. We have a right to collectively then present our beliefs to society and say, this is what we believe as society, and this is what we would like to do, or this is what we would like to see changed, those types of things. So it's just so methodical, just all the way through.
Yeah, I love that. It's a natural progression, and I don't know why. It's such a simple concept, and I'm like, oh, duh, yeah. It is a natural progression. All right, Bill, your final take on that.
So now that Jeremy laid out that so clearly as far as how it just goes from one step to the next, let's answer the question that everybody's waiting for when it comes to the First Amendment, and especially with religion. Are the secularists right? Is this a secular society that the founders set up? Or is this a religious society that the founders set up?
Wow.
And was the separation of church and state to create a secular society or to create a religious society? Wow. So you ready to find out which one is right?
Yes, I think I know or have an answer, but I'm scared to be wrong, so I'm waiting to listen.
Well, they're both wrong.
Okay. All right. And that's what I thought. I was right. Okay.
And they're both right.
Oh, okay.
So both of them are just going too extreme with their particular views, right? The secularists think that it's a purely secular society and the founders didn't want religion involved at the town square at all. And religious people think, well, this is a Christian nation and we're founded on religion. And so religion has to be intertwined and mixed throughout. You even have the religious side that says that, the Bill of Rights is really about taking government out of the church, but not taking the church out of government. You'll hear them say that. And that's absolutely incorrect. The First Amendment is all about taking government out of the church and taking church out of government.
Mm.
John Adams said that when you mix them, when these two entities become bedfellows, he doesn't say only government's corrupted. He said they both are corrupted.
Man.
And this is what history shows, is that both the church and the government gets corrupted when you bring those two together. I mean, you just all you have to do is look at European history to see how much corruption existed, because the church, the Pope, in essence, controlled all of Europe. And he determined who became kings. He determined who was going to be at war with who, because who he authorized to become kings. And I mean, he determined who was going to be the king of France and the king of England, two bitter enemies.
Yeah.
And so isn't that interesting how that would work? So eventually, you know, of course, England got away from the Catholic Church and created the Church of England, because there was a lot of corruption that was happening to both. So to go now though on the secularist side, the secularists are incorrect. This is the founders did not want to create a purely secular society. In fact, James Madison made it very, very clear. He said that if we want a more religious society, if we want more religious zeal and more religious engagement, then history shows us that we need to separate church and state. And about 30 or 40 years after the institution of the legislative acts that Madison put in place in Virginia, the Freedom of Religion Acts, about 30 or 40 years later, he then kind of looked back and he said, by separating church and state, we created a more religious society. And he was praising how great this is, how much better it was, how the doctrines that were taught were more accurate, and how the clergy were better quality, because they weren't as corrupted. They were corrupted by tax dollars and they were doing what politicians wanted to be done. He said the clergy is better. The there's more people attending church. There's more good values and morals and stuff out in society now. And so the goal was to create a more religious society, but they discovered that the best way of doing that was to create a secular government and not let that secular government interfere with religious expression in any way. And so both the religious folks and the secularists should recognize that freedom, and a very large amount of freedom when it comes to the freedom of religion, is necessary. And if both sides would just realize how good it's been for both sides, then they could actually come together and be friends and not constantly be butting heads. So the founders were just brilliant when it came to the First Amendment. And it's a great illustration on how there are times when a lot of freedom is the solution, and other times when we have a little bit more boundaries around the freedom. Sure. It shouldn't all just be a total free-for-all all the time with every single issue, and it also shouldn't be completely regulated and lots of boundaries with some issues. One issue is different than another issue. Religion is different than our monetary system, for example. We handle it differently and have different degrees of freedom, so to speak, or liberty out there. And we actually cover that in another book that the NCCS publishes or sells, and it's the Speaking the Language of Liberty, where we kind of talk a little bit about that. But behind the Bill of Rights, really, I love how it just dives into some of these things that we don't think about, like which is right, the secularists or the religious. And we wanted to come at it from an angle of seriously looking at what's observable and measurable. Both Jeremy and myself are deeply religious men, but we didn't want to come at it from our point of view. We wanted to come at it from a natural law point of view. And we discovered, you know, sometimes us on the religious side, we're a little bit too harsh with our position. And sometimes the secularists are too harsh. And we've got to find that balance.
I like that you guys did that, frankly, because I could see it. I've done it. I've been guilty of going too far on the religious end, if you will. I see the point that you both were making here, and it's absolutely fascinating. And it just takes me back to how brilliant these guys had to be, and revolutionary, in a sense, at that point in time in history. And frankly, this is kind of a weird example, but I was thinking about this as you guys were we're talking, I'm thinking of this concept of the separation of church and state. And then now, and this is me just coming out as a, listen, I'm a conservative. So I always like to attack the left whenever I can. But I see like these ESG scores and all of this stuff. And I'm like, man, in a sense, the left is creating a new type of church and morality, and coupling that with, you know, with government power in order to enforce and impose behavior upon other people. It's like a different type of church and state, but it's not a separation. It's like their church is government, big government and communist ideas, and they're going to impose it upon. Anyway, that's a topic for another day, but that's what started swirling in my
head.
Well,
Jeremy and I were just, talking about that last night, about how the ESG thing with corporations and all that absolutely is a great example of tying religion into policy, and how it's corrupting.
Religion,
it's corrupting both. Absolutely.
Wow.
But yeah. Great topic for future stuff.
All right, we're going to have to add ESG into the Bill of Rights plus ESG. We'll have to talk about that as well. Guys, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you guys. And again, this podcast was a little longer because I wanted to incorporate the general principles, you know, alongside the First Amendment. And these guys did a great job. Make sure you go out and get the book, Behind the Bill of Rights. The authors are Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. Guys, is the best place to get the book ncccs.net? Are there other places? What do you guys recommend? How do people find you? How do people get
it's the available just about anywhere books are sold, in either printed form, on audio, or on ebook. And so you can get it on Amazon. You can get it Barnes & Noble, Walmart. I mean, it's just available a lot of places, and mostly online right now. So look for it online, and if you search for it, Behind the Bill of Rights, go to Amazon, search for it, it'll pop right up.
All right. Guys, listen, I do appreciate it. If you guys will just stay there, we want to make sure we get the show uploaded here. And so I don't want you guys to check out early. I'll close it out here. Again, you've been listening to my guests, Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. They are a part of the National Center for Constitutional Studies. Frankly, I love all of their books. Like I began reading Behind the Bill of Rights, obviously. I'm going to read through this. We're going to continue to have them on weekly because we're going to be doing a 10-part series on the Bill of Rights with these gentlemen. They've done a fantastic job. And what I love about their writing, and frankly, this goes with all of the books from the National Center for Constitutional Studies, they make the complex simple. Like you get it. You understand it. You're like, oh, okay. And honestly, you have to have a high level of intelligence to be able to dumb it down for the people like me. And then what I do, guys, is I take your information. I pretend like I came up with it myself. And then all of a sudden people think I'm brilliant. So I appreciate that aspect of it too. So anyway, but make sure you go out and get the book Behind the Bill of Rights, Timeless Principles That Make It Tick. I love that. All right. So Behind the Bill of Rights, Timeless Principles That Make It Tick by Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. Guys, seriously, get this book. Buy this book for other people. Father's Day is coming up. But this is a book that should be on your bookshelves, along with the 5,000 Year Leap and the Making of America. I remember back in the day, I was doing podcasts and shows on that, and people were like, Carl, you're so good. I was like, oh, thank you. Patting myself on the back, and I knew where I got the information. But we need this. This is what we need. We need to understand what makes America great. These men are helping to do that, helping us to understand that. And so I appreciate you guys for that. Again, Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson. Guys, listen, I appreciate you tuning in to this edition of the Carl Jackson Show podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you go. to get your podcast. We're on Apple, Google, Spotify, you name it. We're there. If you'd like to check out the video, you can go to our YouTube account, The Carl Jackson Show on YouTube. We're also on the free speech platform that I love, Rumble. So you can go to The Carl Jackson Show on either place. Please rate and review. You give us a five. It's going to help us move up the charts. It's going to help more people see and hear this. And those of you that will just be listening to audio, if you would do the same, we certainly appreciate that. Also, on all things social media, I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Getter, True Social, at The Carl Jackson Show is where you can find me. And again, we are going to be doing a 10-part series so you can reference back to these podcasts, so you can share these podcasts, and so that you can gain a greater understanding and knowledge of our founders, what was behind their thinking when they were creating and adapting and adopting, if you will, the Bill of Rights. So I just think that in order to rediscover and to renew our love for America and the founding principles, we have to know what was going on behind the scenes, so to speak. And they do that, Bill Norton and Jeremy Nelson, in Behind the Bill of Rights. So guys, I appreciate you tuning in today. And until next time, do not grow weary doing good, and God bless you.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.